Media shouldn't be one note. Support Rabble.ca and a diversity of voices in Canadian media. Visit rabble.ca/donate to contribute.
This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared creates collaboration, and collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face. So my next interview is with Mark Forster, and for me was a real treat. Mark is a brilliant director. He's a great guy. He's got a lot to say, and we had a really great time. And the film is All I See Is You. It's going to be in the theater very soon. And as he says, this is a meditation on a relationship that is slowly falling apart. We talk about love. We talk about relationships and about choices and about the need to speak up more. You know, in the context of any relationship, really. And, you know, again, this is a film about silence and about listening. And, you know, one of the themes that's really bubbled to the surface for me at the festival has been about silence and what are we missing out on when we don't, you know, ask the relevant question or speak up or sort of dial into a conversation or an issue or whatever the situation might be. So you're gonna enjoy this interview. As I said, it was a real treat for me. You're gonna enjoy Mark. You're gonna enjoy the film coming right up. Mark Forster and All I See Is You. DavidPeckLive.com for more interviews. My book, Real Change Is Incremental. You can book me there for live speaking engagements, and also rabble.ca for more information and more interviews coming from the digitally live from the Toronto International Film Festival. Mark Forster and All I See Is You. Well, welcome to Face to Face. We're joined by a very special guest today. Mark Forster is here today to talk about his new film. Just landed, I think.
Yes, I just got to Toronto.
Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
And we're going to talk about your film. I think I have a feeling, based on our conversation before the recorder started, we're going to be talking about a few other things too. But All I See Is You. Am I your first interview at the Toronto International Film Festival?
No, we
have. Come on.
Unfortunately, not. But you know what, it feels like that an interview I'm actually looking forward to, because you're not just purely approaching, it seems like, movies from a cinematic point of view, so from a like social political point of view as well.
Absolutely. I approach it cinematically if the structure is helping to move the story forward. If that makes any sense.
Sometimes it doesn't.
That's true. Well, I have to say, Southeast Asia, Thailand, the relational component of this film drew me in right away. And first of all, congratulations.
Thank you.
And and welcome back to Toronto.
Thank you.
And can I say I'm a big fan? Monsters Ball, Stranger Than Fiction. I mean, come on, ridiculous.
Thank you. This is
crazy. No, here we are in this makeshift phone booth at the Intercontinental Hotel. It seems a little disrespectful.
I like the pattern, the carpet.
Yes.
Keeps you on edge versus the blue velvet we're sitting on here.
It's a bit of a postmodern edge to it.
Yes.
It's a little unsettling.
Yeah.
So is this film? I mean, it's about a lot of things, clearly, or maybe not so clearly in some respects. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the narrative? A lot of the listeners probably won't have seen it yet.
It's basically a sort of meditation of a relationship that's slowly sort of falling apart. It comes to me, I really wanted to look into relationships, because so many relationships, if you look at them, are codependence and based on codependency and are, you know, often a big mess. And people, you know, often want to scream at their partner but don't. They remain silent, and the more they remain silent, the deeper the spiral you know, sort of goes, and the darker or the more difficult the relationship becomes for them to actually stay together. Or and that's what I wanted to you know, express, is to really look at it in a closed loop, because I think so many people aren't able to express anymore what they feel often about their partner. And it's so much about, you know, I love strong female protagonists. I like the metaphorical point of view of sight. You know, the reason I chose the title All I See Is You, for instance, is because it can be used on both sides of the of the line, from both point of
views. So she's pretty much lost her eyesight as a result of a car accident for about 20 years.
About 15, yeah.
15 years, and not a full loss.
No,
walks with a walking stick, and we see that she really depends on her husband. At a certain level, is dependent on him, but maybe not so much. And then has an operation, restores one eye.
Yes, basically has a cornea operation,
and then essentially implant. Things begin to change.
Yes.
But I mean, the question I guess I got for you from a relational perspective is, it makes me wonder, you know, the eye becomes the catalyst, and yet what was sort of bubbling below the surface?
Yes, one could say, yes, the eye is the catalyst, but it's more, for me, it was always bubbling below the surface. And it's not, what I think is important when people also go in to see the film is, you know, narratives can be explored in different ways. Mm-hmm. And I think often, people to this day and age have, like, you know, a certain box what you often expect of a movie, and you say, I'm expecting to see a thriller, but it is not a thriller because it doesn't have that typical payoff. One looks at this relationship under a loop, and what I think is interesting for me is sort of, because we're in a visual medium, that every frame tells a story, and every frame is sort of informs us about the, you know, identity of each of these characters, and that's what I was trying to play with as well. Which,
interesting that you bring up expectations. I mean, talk about relational expectations.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems like he's really uncomfortable with where things go. I mean, that's an understatement, right? He's just, I mean, actually actively and in a very destructive way working against change in the relationship.
Yeah.
So there's a real fear there. So it kind of brings up the whole notion to me anyway of what we bring to the table in a theater, obviously, to your point, but also to each other, right? And this idea for me, you know, I'm so glad you brought up the idea of silence. It's clearly, I'm at about 12 or 13 interviews for the festival so far, and it's been a theme this year in many of the docs I've seen, this idea that if we don't speak up, then what?
Yeah, that's. I mean, I think that's, for me, is the crucial point that we, in our society in general, we need to speak up more and more. And it seems like people are more and more silenced. And you know, the more we depend on technology, often the less we connect individually. And it's often our technological connection is not the same than our individual connection. And I think there are two different things. Not that this goes into the movie, but I'm just...
Right, yeah, sure, yeah. Yeah, well, actually, I don't care if we really talk about the movie on some level.
Okay.
we're going a little deeper, it seems to me. So what was really ironic for me, and I actually did not expect the breakdown, I was really drawn into the relationship. I was really drawn into there was a sense of playfulness. They really seemed to be pretty madly in love, and maybe not. Maybe they really weren't. Or was that? Is that something we all kind of face, do you think, in our relationships?
I do think with this. Yes, I do think absolutely. I mean, partly because I wrote the script with a friend of mine, is partly what I went personally through in some of my relationships, but then I observed also with my parents and with friends, and I felt like that there were certain things of I felt were repetitious and also personal, but also I think one could generalize where I observed this in several relationships, and I think there are some people they meet and they're soulmates for the rest of their lives. Right. And they have a great
it's
love.
Just the way it's going
to
be.
Yes, and it's fantastic. But that chance to meet your soulmate is very rare.
Mm.
I think most of relationships go through this lifespan of being tremendously attracted, incredible in love, in this honeymoon phase, and ultimately there comes a point where you're not fulfilling each other, either intellectually, sexually, or just you're getting bored of each other, or there's a conflict, or the other person starts to annoy you and you don't express it. And it's like they even made scientifically research, which is interesting, is men that tune out the voice vibration of their wives, someone who is married for 30 years,
wow,
that they almost tune out the voice of their magnificent other.
So they've picked, physiologically they've picked up on the frequency.
Yes, of the voice frequency of their wife.
And they
literally scientifically.
Well, even if it's not true, it's still a pretty interesting
theory,
notion or
yes,
metaphor, right?
Yeah.
Because I think whether it is true or not, I think a lot of us do it. Right?
Yes.
We're pretty good. I teach international development once a year, and my listeners have heard this many times, but I joke with my students and I say three things to be a good development worker. You've got to listen, you got to listen, and you got to listen, right?
Yeah.
And then big laugh, and we talk about that, but really, that when we go into another culture, and it's really easy to go in and not listen at all. And I go into another culture, so I'm wearing the straw fedora, 6 foot, white. I apparently have all the answers, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's so how, I don't know. I mean, did at some point, did these two stop listening to each other, do you think? Is that the blindness?
Yes.
Is that because?
Yes, you got it on, or you hit it on the nail, that partly.
It's not about sight necessarily,
no,
right, Mark?
No, exactly.
Yeah, okay.
It's not necessarily about sight. The sight is purely, it's like people who look at the film on the surface, they only see the sight and see the sight, yes, as a metaphor as this, but ultimately it's not about that. It's literally at the end, it's about listening, and that's why I also put the song at the end, because it's the song that he finally listens.
Right.
And he's
finally
got it.
Right.
And that's when she's telling him it, and she couldn't express it to him in sort of words, so she's sort of almost sings it to him, which is sort of like almost like fairy tale-ish.
Yes,
and you
yes,
can say,
yes.
Oh, this is like a little silly, but it's also a child song that then becomes about their relationship.
It's pretty heartbreaking, actually. I think anyone who's been through, say, the massive sweeping generalization here, but most people who have been through breakups of a particular kind, I think, will be able to resonate with moments in the film where there's, I don't know, there's just this sense of longing, for me anyway. There was this sense of course, the metaphor of sight and so on, and on a certain level is just below the surface. But there's a sense of, this sense of loneliness within the context of a relationship. And that, to me, is a huge, huge tragedy.
Yeah.
How long did they live this? You know, this couple, many years.
It's, you know, I always, like, I was a big fan always early on of sort of these movies from Bergman, or also from Polanski, like movies like Repulsion or A Knife in the Water, and then also like the Bergman movie like Persona or White Strawberries and so on. And I always feel like there is in those, there's this sort of loneliness in relationships always fascinate me, and it also fascinates me that so many people are lonely in relationships and trying to actually want to leave but can't, and even there's an unhealthy nature for each other, that they're like sort of are not good for each other, they still stay in the relationship, and they don't leave each other because of that codependency. And I feel like that's often sort of you rather be in status quo instead of initiating a change. And I feel like that goes across of talking about international development often, that there are moments which are, things are so bad that you ultimately are, like, everybody is frozen, that they're ultimately paralyzed to get out of that situation, then saying, okay, this doesn't work, let's just cut it off, let's basically, you know, amputate.
Do you think it's all broken relationships are repairable?
No, I actually believe that ultimately, and that's the other thing, that I believe you either are in love and you're connected and you're right for each other, and you're not, but I do not believe that through couple therapy or through a way that you really can find true happiness again. I do think you find maybe you can become content and you accept the situation.
Sure.
But and accept the situation you're in and find contentment in that, but I do not find you find complete bliss and fulfillment.
Well, it's almost like you learn how to manage your discontent.
Yes, exactly.
right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. To your comment about the status quo and the whole codependency thing, right? And it just really becomes quite unhealthy. And I think for me, as I don't know if you've read much French philosophy, but this whole idea of becoming who we are.
Yeah.
I mean, that's going to, it's so ironic.
Yeah. Right?
You know, the existential movement says we know ourselves in relation to others.
Yeah.
Right? German existentialism, same thing.
Yes.
Right? Thanks to, you know, Heidegger and a few others.
Yes.
And it's so ironic that people will stay
in
a relationship that isn't actually helping to reveal who they actually are. Does that make any sense?
Absolutely. If you go back to even, like, I'm sure you read Sartre.
Yes.
You know, the weak clo when they're all in hell,
Nausea,
pretty much.
Nausea, one of my favorite novels of all time.
And it's like, you know, we are just, that's all we have.
Yeah.
like, pretty much looking at each other.
Yeah.
And that's sort of that idea of hell.
Yeah, I often misquote hell as other people if depending on the context I'm in. So would you say, as a filmmaker, that, I mean, I'm sure there's certain themes that brought you to the art form in the first place, that brought you to the craft, that said, I need to say this, I want to express this, or I want to, I don't know, change the world in a particular way. What, I mean, relationships clearly, from what I know of your filmic history, I guess it grows along the way and changes too.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it all starts always with character and also myself, what I'm going through in the world, what the stories I want to tell. But, you know, it's interesting. I grew up in Switzerland in the mountains and I didn't have a lot of friends growing up. It was very sort of isolated. And so I behind my parents' house, we had this forest and I always just played there and sort of like made up imaginary friends, basically, to keep me company. And ultimately, that, you know, as a kid, that's all fun and games. But suddenly, you know, I came to an age where I had to figure out what I'm going to do. And I realized, like, the escape in storytelling is the escape of this reality. And I believe the reality we live in here right now is not, you know, if you look at just... into physics, and I always loved physics, that this is not the only reality, but our belief system is so strong that we believe each other, that ultimately there are parallel realities that exist, but we not allow them to see them. And you know, I feel just in physics-wise, those do exist, but because of our belief system, we are very much narrowed down in this matter. And what I find is interesting is ultimately that if you have a newborn and you give that newborn love, it will flourish. If you project negativity on it, it will survive. If you ignore it, it will die. So ultimately, our attention has shifted lately. That our attention used to be much more based on us individually, and now it's more based on our gadget, like the phone or computers. So that reality becomes gets more attention or our focus than actually us as individuals gets less, and kids get less. And I'm wondering how that sort of generation that's born now, how it will be, because their parents give them less attention than we got when we were younger.
So can I tell you a little story? So I go home yesterday, a grueling couple of days here at TIFF, and I'm not complaining, but it's exhausting, as you well know. My son wants to go on a scooter. I take him out with a bunch of skateboarders. I used to skateboard for years. I bring a bunch of Hollywood magazines with me, you know, the Variety and Hollywood Reporter. And I get reprimanded by my son over dinner because I didn't spend enough time watching them. And he says to Elizabeth, my wife, oh, Dad spent the whole time reading his magazines. He was quite, I think, hurt that I did. So this whole idea of relational shift, I mean, it doesn't have to be just tech. I mean, tech is definitely a high offender.
Yeah.
But again, it's paying attention to the details,
yeah.
Right? It's listening to others, right?
So he was actually upset that you weren't.
I think he was having a little fun with me. I think he's 11 years old, so he's already got a little sense of humor and a bit of sarcasm going on. But I think he was a little upset that I hadn't spent. And he went. You know, he's like his dad. He's gifted in hyperbole, so he made some crack about how he almost crashed into a wall, and I didn't. I didn't see him. So, of course, I woke up this morning feeling quite convicted, actually.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. It makes you feel guilty.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. I agree with you.
And I think, and it's an interesting question, I think, too, as a filmmaker. I wanted to ask you, does it frustrate you that, and I don't know, maybe this is a silly question, that more people, you know, you commented before the recorder was on about Stranger Than Fiction, you know, it played, it wasn't really noticed, critics, how do you deal with that frustration? I mean... Maybe that's the wrong question.
You know, the thing is, I mean, I've been very blessed. I had, you know, big films that have been recognized early on, like Finding Neverland or Monsters Ball or even World War Z or Kite Runner or movies like that. And then so certain films, that when they fall through the crack or people don't like them, that's, you have to live with that. And I feel I've been blessed and thankful for that. But at the same time, ultimately, as a filmmaker, you want people to see your work.
Of course. Yeah.
And for me, it's more about if... I want them to see it. If they don't like it or like it, is secondary. I want it to spark conversation. If someone tells me, look, I don't like your work because of this, and I say, yes, I think it's absolutely your right and your taste, and yes, you know, looking at it, like looking at a film, and you can say narratively, I didn't feel like that story build it the way I wanted to build, yes, but there's maybe in any kind of movie or visually it didn't work or whatever it is, someone is agitated that didn't work for them, I think it's an interesting question. Okay, why didn't it work for them? Because walked in with a frame of mind, this is a perfect movie. First act, second and third act, it has to build, then it has to change, the character has to change, has to shift, and ultimately has a payoff that... And I think, to be honest, I think it's one of the problems of cinema today, because you look at the hero's journey, and I think the hero's journey is ultimately that at the end everything has to be wrapped up. And I think that's why television today is so incredibly sort of...
Empty?
No, but that there are a lot of great TV shows. But the thing is, it's because you don't... you can take your time. You're not in a rush.
Right.
Leave it open ended.
What Netflix and HBO and some are starting to do now, right? Some of the stories they're starting to take.
And you can take more time. It can be open ended. You can just adjust to the characters. And that used to be the chase in cinema in the 70s. But today, that has shifted. And that's that part of storytelling just has shifted. And I think those films are rarer and rarer. And I think. To make movies with originality and provoke and shift it up is, if you fail or not, that's secondary, but I think it's absolutely crucial
And how do you define failure? I'm sure as an artist and as a filmmaker, there are certain people you want to keep happy.
Yeah.
You know, you've got the commercial aspect of it, you've got funding for your next film, you're concerned about your strategy, your writing.
Constantly.
Right? It's ridiculous, right?
Yes.
While you were talking, one of the thoughts I had while you were talking about the hero's journey what we talked about earlier, expectations and what you bring into a film or a relationship, maybe critics are exactly the wrong people to be reviewing movies.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. That's interesting. I never thought of that.
Yeah.
Maybe they are.
Well, I mean, talk about presupposition.
Yeah.
Talk about expectation. This better deliver or.
Yes.
And then let's talk about juxtaposition. And what did you just see 20 minutes ago? When you're at a film festival, how is that impacting what you're now going to watch?
Absolutely.
Right? Did you see some black and white 16 millimeter film and you're putting it up against some, right?
Yes. So and you're like, ultimately, you have to watch so many movies, cover them, that you ultimately, I mean, you are tired, you are exhausted because it's endless.
Yeah. Okay. So I think the soundbite for me in this interview is that maybe critics are the wrong people to be reviewing films. I think
Or maybe they're the wrong people reviewing at a film festival.
That's right, at a film festival. Yes. Maybe that's
because it. I think you know, there's some critics. For instance, Roger Ebert was someone who was a big supporter for me early on. He made at the time called Monsters Ball Best Film of the Year, and I met with him many times, had long conversations about film, and he was a real cinephile.
He really was.
And he was really just one of those great critics. And I felt like to have a critic of his stature, review my movie. And I made a movie for Stay once. It was very bad reviewed, didn't do it well at the box office. It was with Ryan Gosling, Ewan McGregor, Naomi Watts. And he was one of the very few people who gave it a good review. Mm. But he also criticized it.
Mm.
And the way he constructively took it apart and really thought about it, I was amazed. And I said, like, I just should show him my movies beforehand, because even just here, his criticism was cinematic and interesting and not coming from my personal sort of ego-driven, oh, this is shit or this is good.
Right.
Like, it's not that black and white.
He strikes me as the kind of guy who had... had an ongoing dialogue, not only with film, but with others pretty much all the time.
Yes, right? And it's that dialogue, I think, is interesting and sort of creates and makes the art, you know, grow. Because I think for any filmmaker, I mean, I have, you know, any filmmaker had reviews, doesn't matter who it is in their life, where someone really just didn't like the movie. And you look at them and it affects you. But at this point, I'm looking at them, okay, I said, what is this person really saying, or what are they going through? And then when you look at it, sometimes it's, you know, I feel bad sometimes for other filmmakers, especially early on.
Especially young filmmakers.
Yes.
It's gotta be crazy hard,
right? And I think they put their heart into make a film, and everybody knows how hard it is to get the money to make a movie. It's one thing, a miracle to make it, another miracle to actually make a successful movie, another miracle that it becomes a hit. There's so many miracles involved in that journey. But then someone to get literally shut down, especially young filmmakers, which I feel like, you know, you should try and keep making interesting work.
I think it's a good leap into one of my favorite moments in the film. I mean, I have lots, but and lots of cinematic favorites as well. But the and I don't think we're tipping our hats here, but the argument over the room that they go to.
Yes.
And it may look the same, but it's not the same. For me, favorite moment. Not only the dialogue, but the way it plays out, and the way we actually find out that, you know, she's right and he's wrong.
Yeah.
Isn't that what we're talking about here with the critics?
Yes.
Isn't it the same sort of conversation in a way? It's about perspective and expectations.
Look, I again.
Pay attention to detail.
Yes, I mean, I like critics. I do. I like critics.
That's why I'm having fun here.
But no, I do. I do like the critics. And they have been good to me most of the time.
Yeah, sure.
So some maybe not, but most of the time they've been good. But the thing is, what I feel like it may look the same, but it's not, is what I think, you know, often life is about. You know, give me a mask and I tell you the truth.
Mm.
That's what I think it boils down to often. And it's also, if the title, when she looks at herself, is "All I See Is You," it's often that all we see is us. And I think it's also time to, in a sense, to really see each other. Because in a sense, I always feel like the way I treat others, I want to be treated myself. And it's like, as a filmmaker, you know, you have your sort of, because you then, making All I See Is You, as a filmmaker, I have my vision, but ultimately I'm telling the vision of a character who is discovering themselves.
Right. Well, this is what I love.
But I'm putting my vision on top of actually her vision. So whose vision really is it?
Right. Now we're getting profoundly philosophical, which I love. But this is to me is an exercise in self-actualization. It's a dialogue about existentialism, in a way, about becoming who we are. I mean, a lovely image that you end with in the film.
Yes.
Right? I mean, what's next?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it's beautiful, and it's this is what it means to be human.
Yeah.
You don't get much more profoundly human than that, it seems to me. Which I think, I mean, I certainly see that thread in your films, for sure. Have you ever had an MRI?
Yeah.
You have, so have I.
I put it in the movie, because it flipped me out. It was a personal experience, and that's why I put it in there.
I wondered, because it's such a great sort of piece of foreshadowing, I think. What would it be like to be blind?
The claustrophobia.
Inside, you know, the claustrophobia. Yeah, exactly. Which essentially, you know.
And my experience, you have this little mirror, so you see, I don't know if you ever had it, but Yeah, I had a little bump here. I had a friend of mine who thought I had a brain tumor and I was going to die, so that's why I had to do it. I didn't, but God thanks. But anyway, there was a little mirror, and I'm looking, and I see the lab tech.
Oh, that's right. You can see it.
It says, see it through the mirror, the lab tech. And I'm lying there, and I said, and I'm talking to Mr. Mike, I said, I need to get out. And he's like, and I, because he doesn't, he knows that, I don't know if he forgot that I can see him. And he was like, he's like waving his hands, and it's like, what, really? Now I have to get him out? So it's like, awesome. He's already annoyed. So he pulls me out again, completely pissed off, annoyed. We have to do this again.
Yeah.
So he shoves me back in again. I said, okay, this time it's going to work. I'm going to stay in this MRI.
It's for anyone who hasn't done it, you can't really explain it. There's a hospital just outside of Toronto where they will let you put goggles on and you can watch a movie. So I highly recommend that. And then pick something really, you know.
Yeah, calming.
Yeah, exactly.
Like All I See Is You.
Yeah, like All I See Is You. How's
the
this?
MRI scene.
How's this? So I've had several over the years, in the last couple of years. And probably the best experience for me was when the nurse clearly understood what was going on and has been down this road before. And she, he's looking for the washroom, came over and she put her hands, my legs were sticking out, and she put her hands on my shins and my feet. Nothing odd about it at all. It was just beautifully relational.
Yeah.
And Mark, immediately, I just calmed. I'm getting goosebumps.
It's the human touch.
The human touch. I calmed down and boom. I was 20 minutes later, I'm out. And I said, what's interesting, I was going through about a two-year period, and I said to my doctors, you got to keep sending me back to that same hospital. And I told them the story every time. Talk about humanizing something that's so, you know.
Yeah.
Why? So we got to wrap this up in a couple minutes, which I hate, by the way. Why Thailand?
I originally just always wanted to set the story in a city that there were the expats, so that Gina, Blake Lively's character, is more alienated. Mm. That ultimately she does not only see, but she also doesn't understand the language. And the alienation, I thought, was very important. Also, for like that he chose that they're not living in a city almost, that he even can have more control over her. At the same time, I could be Shanghai, Hong Kong, Bangkok, either. So ultimately, when I was talking to different financial partners in those countries,
right.
For the Thailand, my financial partner in Thailand was really understood the movie, really got what I was going for, and so I thought it would be the right place to make the movie.
Well, it's a great film. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
You.
And I have to say I was really unsettled by where we wound up. And that's not to say that it was a dark film in a sense, but just because you drew me into this relationship in a way, and then you kind of, we did a quick U-turn. Because these people were just, you know, madly in love.
Yeah.
And just did sort of a quick U-turn throughout the film. Thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it, Mark Forster. All I See Is You here at the Toronto International Film Festival. I hope we can do part two down the road. But
yes, I really enjoyed the conversation and really hope that another time we can talk some more.
I really enjoyed that. Because as we both know, hell is other people.
Yes, as we both know, all those other people. That's funny. Have you been on a cruise ship ever before?
Have I been on a cruise ship? Yes, I have actually.
Yes, that's an interesting experience. Being stuck on a cruise ship with other people.
Yes, we'll end that there. That'll be for part two.